Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis, and this is our 44th webinar. Tonight's webinar is entitled Mending Autism. It's Elementary, my dear Watson. And we have presenting that Dr. Jerry Cartsonell. Dr. Jerry Cartsonell is a board-certified pediatrician and a fellow in the American Academy of Pediatrics. He specializes in the recovery of neurodevelopmental chronic neuroinflammatory diseases and hormonal dysfunctions. He's a nationally recognized speaker and New York Times best-selling author. Dr. Cartsonell has presented medical interventions that work to improve the lives of his patients who suffer from many types of medical conditions that include autism, allergies, inflammatory bowel disease, chronic constipation, chronic diarrhea, sleep cycle disruptions, and hormonal imbalances. He regularly teaches continuing medical education courses on children's health issues to physicians and other health professionals. His clinical approach is to treat the whole patient by carefully obtaining a full and complete history, and based on that history, obtaining very detailed laboratory evaluations. Individualized plans are implemented, integrating the very latest medical interventions that include both traditional and complementary medicine approaches. Welcome, Dr. Cartsonell.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be here with Moms Fighting Autism, but I'd like to think some dads are helping us in this fight. Can't do it all on our own. Tonight we are going to talk about autism and my approach to the treatment, but I don't really treat autism. That's the secret here. We don't treat autism. But what we are doing is we are treating the underlying medical problems, and we have to diagnose them, understand what's going on, and then obviously we're going to have to manage them. And many of the children that I see in my clinic from all around the world have some commonalities. They've got GI issues, and GI just another way of saying gut, gastrointestinal issues. Sleep issues, allergic issues, immune issues, neurologic and psychiatric issues, endocrine issues, chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, and even toxic issues. So if I was able to see you all at it like I would at a conference, I would say, how many of you have a child who doesn't sleep at night? And probably half of you would raise your hand. How many of you have children with constipation? How many of you have diarrhea, chronic diarrhea? How many of your kids don't eat? In other words, we have these children that we call autistic. That's not really a diagnosis. It's just a collection of symptoms. And how I define autism is these children are not making sense of information coming to them. When mom says, I love you, dad says, go get your shoes. Maybe their stomach's saying they're hungry. I mean, some of these kids won't eat. They just don't understand what that feeling of hunger is in their stomach or what a full bladder or rectum is. That's why they can't be potty trained. My son could walk on hot gravel in bare feet in the middle of summer. Obviously, something between the hot gravel and his brain didn't figure out, ouch, I need to get off of here, and maybe cry would be good. In other words, information coming to their brain from the nose, the mouth, the eyes, the ears, the touch, it doesn't make much make sense to them. And some kids more and some kids less. So what we're going to try and do is figure out what's wrong with these kids and help them out. Now, back in 1943, when they coined the word autism, this is Leo Kanner's work, not only did he notice that these kids were aloof and distant, but he also noted they had medical problems, too, that nowadays seems to be kind of ignored. Case number one says eating has always been a problem. Case number two, large and ragged tonsils. Case number three, diarrhea and fever following smallpox vaccination. So these children have true medical problems. So the question then begs to be answered, well, if we address each of these medical problems and make them better, will the child's symptoms of autism get better? And the answer is yes. So what we have here is a child who's exposed to something, and we'll call it toxins. And it could start in utero. I mean, obviously, if mom's doing drugs or has alcohol or is a big fish eater or got flu vaccine with mercury, but somehow toxins enter the body either in utero, inside mom's tummy, or when we're born. And there's an element of oxidative stress, kind of represented there by those oxidizing chains, and inflammation. And you combine that with the child's own genetics, that's the DNA strand there, and you get some kind of disease. You get something, whether it be reflux or recurrent ear infections or diarrhea, you get something, okay? So to have a disease process, these things have to occur. So good science and physiology will provide many answers. We could think about this. So what is physiology? It's the study of the mechanical, physical, and biochemical functions of living organisms. And that's what I studied in medical school. That's what I studied in college, physiology. And we know that there are healthy cells, and then we also understand there are different ways to hurt a cell. And in this slide, it's not to be memorized, but basically you have a cell that's growing normally, doing normal things. We call it normal metabolism. But certain things can impact it, you know, and make the cell not do so well. You know, radiation, inflammation, smog, chemicals. But something has to come in and start to cause some stress on the cell, some damage on the cell. Now, let me translate this. What we have here then is damage to things inside the cell, and they can be protein damage or membrane damage, DNA damage, mitochondrial damage, and that's why when you hear about the latest theories about autism and they say it's mitochondrial disorder or it's this or it's that, you can see why, because certain of these areas are damaged, they're impacted, and when cells don't work right, the child is going to struggle. Okay, whether it be energy, muscle tone, language, recognition of information coming into his body, brain cells. And one of the things that many people keep hearing about is antioxidants. And we make antioxidants. One of the ones that we make is called glutathione. And it's our main way of protecting our body from damaging exposures to the environmental toxins that we're exposed to. You know, we are going to be exposed to a bunch of stuff. And glutathione basically is the giant detoxifier. And glutathione is made in a certain particular pathway. Now, Dr. Jill James was wondering, this was a few years ago, I wonder if these toxins that all kids are exposed to, but only some of them react poorly, hence our diagnosis of autism perhaps, maybe these children with autism don't have as much glutathione. And that's exactly what she showed. She looked at neurotypical children and measured glutathione levels. And there's a bunch of biochemical stuff, but the little box surrounds the area. GSH means glutathione. And she said, oh my gosh, the control children have almost twice as much as this glutathione as the autistic children do. So maybe that's why they were able to escape relatively unscathed by whatever environmental issues came along and hurt the child. So if you have a lot of what we call oxidative stress, in other words, you don't have enough antioxidant to neutralize it, this decreases your body's ability to make more of that glutathione we were talking about. And the less glutathione you have, the sicker you can get, or at least more prone to inflammation. Now, we get into inflammation, and we're going to make a lot of sense of this as this talk goes on. Methylation, and this is the pathway that makes glutathione. So we're each born with these biochemical machineries that make glutathione, and it's made by this process called the methylation pathway. So we have these biochemical factories that are designed to methylate and make glutathione. Now, some of us have more factories than others. Now, when you have a family history of fewer methylation factories, fewer ability to make glutathione, you will see in the family the history of alcoholism, bipolar disease, schizophrenia, depression, attention deficit disorder, autism, constipation, and even suicide. In fact, I've had two moms in my practice with autism actually commit suicide. So we know that in problems with processing information, if you don't have enough glutathione, you are going to be prone to this. So when I talk to parents, I say, well, let me ask you, is there alcoholism, bipolar disease, schizophrenia? And mom will always volunteer. That's all on his side of the family, okay, not my side. But she's kidding. I mean, obviously we've got that. But that's one group of kids. I mean, we have this that we can address because I can fix this. You see, that's where I'm going with all this. This is one area that we can work on and make better. That's why you may have heard, if you're new to this, you're going to hear about it. If you've been studying for a few years, like many of us, you'll have heard, well, I've heard about the methyl B12 shots. Well, what they do is they push your methylation factories pathway to make more glutathione. And when you make more glutathione, then you can go around and be the antioxidant your body's been waiting for, and systems start to work better. And that's the whole idea, is to get things working better. So we tend to add folic acid to the B12 and TMG and DMG. And by the way, you'll see on the slide this little thing called Mending Autism. I have a blog, mendingautism.com, and you can read about all of these things, methylation pathway, B12. You can read all about this in greater detail, but I explain it kind of the way I'm talking to you. It's not hoity-toity, like I'm the professor and you just have to bear with me. I bring it to you as if I'm parent to parent, because I do have a child with autism, just turned 16. So my wife would hit me over the head if I tried to be Mr. Professor here. So as we get further along, we'll be able to take questions, and if something you're getting stuck on, we'll be able to get that to me. So anyway, the process of the methylation pathways to make glutathione, many of us are born with sticky factories just because of this genetics. Okay, we got exposed to some toxins. Some people say vaccines, some say it's the PCBs, whatever. And all of a sudden, we find out quickly in our society who's not going to be able to detoxify themselves. And then the clinical manifestation is this thing that we call autism. And different people have different propensities. I mean, the Somalis are easily poisoned, and they have a lot of autism. South Korea just published 1 in 30 males in South Korea has autism. And the Asian population isn't prone to admit to much in the foreign countries like Japan and China. I'm working with China right now. They don't really keep tabulation because they don't feel comfortable sharing that. But I'm telling you that certain groups seem to be a little more prone, but it can happen to anybody. So that's methylation. And when I talk about pathways, this is all that we know about the biochemical pathways in the cell in 2012, and this methylation pathway is right where that arrow is. So you can see there's a lot of stuff. You can almost think about it as one cog in a very big transmission. And if that one cog doesn't work well, that one gear doesn't work well, then things happen and the cell doesn't work the way it was designed to. So when you have abnormal physiologic functions, then downstream, there are going to be problems. So here are the four big problems we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about each one individually. But the first one is immune system. There's a shift in how our immune system fights disease. And that's a Th1, Th2 shift. If you read about it now, I'm just going to familiarize you with a little bit of the physiology. And I promise you, the whole talk is not going to be like this. We're going to get into some fun stuff in a little bit. But I'm trying to lay some groundwork on why our kids are broken or not functioning well. So you have this immune shift, and what that really means is if Th1, the T helper cell 1 of the immune system, isn't working well, these children will have problems with bacteria, viral, and fungal infections. And so they're going to be the kids who have 20 different ear infections, sinus infections, always have something, bowel disease, fever, whatever. And Th2 makes us allergic. These kids tend to be very allergic. Allergic to the world, they could be allergic to house dust mite, mold, or whatever. The next time we're going to frame shift through these, we'll be talking about the tummy, gastrointestinal stripping of the gut, its ability to keep foreign things out, dysbiosis, inflammation. We're going to talk a little bit about the neurologic impact, inflammation in the brain, alterations in serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. And then finally, the endocrine issues that we have. So these kids have lots of issues. And I'm going to hopefully just paint a nice big picture this evening about all the things that we can positively do something about, because I'm not into telling you what's wrong and saying, but I have nothing to fix it. What I'm doing is I'm going to be showing you things that might pertain to your child that you can go to your doctor with and say, hey, I've got these interesting observations here. Let's do something about it. So consequences of the abnormal physiological functions, TH1, TH2, I'm going to spend a little time on that, and then we're going to go down that list that I just showed you. These children show the allergic shiners, those big dark circles under the eyes. They have eczema, dry skin, you know, on the forearms, behind the knees, around the ankles. They can have fungal skin infections, oral thrush, you know, like little babies get, the little white tongue. They can get these little skin warts called molluscum contagiosum. They look like little pearls with a dimple in the middle, or they can get warts. Everybody knows what a wart looks like. And then I can look from a blood test point of view, I can look at autoimmune markers, increased IgE, which is a marker for allergies, abnormal killer, natural killer cell function. These are things that go around actually killing germs, and that's why your kid's sick all the time, because his natural killer cells are down. IgA deficiency, low white blood cell count, and T-cell abnormalities. These are immune system workup I can do. So where I get frustrated as a physician is a parent will bring a child to me and say, you know, my son's had, you know, 15 ear infections, 20 different rounds of antibiotics. And I'll say, oh, really? What happened to the immune system workup? Well, we never did get one. We just, after the 8th ear infection, they went and sent us to the ENT and he put in tubes. I mean, really? You have a child who's getting recurrent infections and you don't say, I wonder what's wrong with the immune system? So these are things that I can look at if this is one of the children that come to me. So the consequences then of the immune system not working properly is allergies, repeated infection. Moms will say, why can't you keep my kid free of yeast? And I'm saying, look, his immune system has to do it. The next thing I'd like to talk about is the gut, and that's gastrointestinal. So you'll see that abbreviated GI, just because nobody wants to write gastrointestinal all the time, but that's the gut, and the stripping of the gut. So what's going on here is the immune system, just here we are back to that darn immune system again. You know, 80% of your entire immune system is dedicated to the digestive tube, from the mouth all the way down to the anus. 80% of your immune system is focused around keeping that tube healthy. And if it's not working properly, we can get some germs growing in there. And this is just a picture of some parasites. I get the coolest parasites in these kids. Very interesting. But what that translates into, when the gut is not working properly, when the immune system isn't working well, it translates into a parent saying, look, kind of like what we talked about earlier, the child is not perceiving the world in a proper way. Okay? Things don't make sense to him. His ability to talk, his ability to understand, his ability to be taught, his ability to get dressed, heck, his ability to eat or even use a toilet. Things aren't working right. And I tell parents that part of this thing also relates internally. In other words, they're not responding to the bladder. They're not responding to the rectum. They're not responding to cues of hot or cold or danger. Okay? But you have to remember that all of these things are biochemically mediated. In other words, all this information gets turned into electricity and it's interpreted by the brain. You know, it's like when you hear the door, somebody at the door knocking, you open up the door and it's your neighbor, Sam, and his face is instantly digitalized by your retina. And that information goes to the back of your brain where all of the faces you've ever seen since you were a child are compared, and it comes up with Sam, my next door neighbor, and then comes to a point where I'm like, a greeting, and then who are you? Why are you here? So everything that we see is electronically, chemically mediated. So if things are off, then we're going to have a problem with that. So that's a parent's perspective. So what I tend to do is I take a whole case history. I listen to when, you know, was your child born normal? And then after the 6-month vaccines, we lost them, or the 15-month MMR, or was the child always off? Was the child even vaccinated? I mean, we get a whole history. And what approach has been taken already? What has anybody done? Did they do some genetics already? Did somebody do an MRI? Has he got epilepsy? Has he got seizures? But what's going on there? Who's involved in teams? Speech therapy, physical therapy, ABA therapy, no therapy? So I paint this broad picture, and then I look for patterns and details. Like, for example, tantrums. Docky always tantrums before he has a bowel movement. He always tantrums before a meal. He's so much better after eating. I can't get him to sleep. As soon as the sun goes down, the kid goes crazy. all kinds of patterns and details. And then, of course, I have to think of these biochemical aberrations that we've been talking about. So when I see them in my, when I see the child and the parents in my clinic, you know, the parents have got lots of concerns. Not only have they got the here's what he's not doing well, responding well-wise in my environment, I can't get him to hold a crayon properly or whatever, but I've also got foul-smelling stools that happen to be yellow and green, or a bloated belly, right? Doc, I'm waiting to hear him speak. You know, before my son was speaking, I used to have dreams where I was having conversations with my son, Josh. So I understand that need for a parent to want to hear something. Not sleeping. That's the biggest thing I do for parents is try and fix that. Hard to get down, hard to keep them asleep. Mom has to sleep with them. They have to do this funny ritual to get the kid to go to sleep. Does not do well with running errands. They tantrum. They can't transition from the house to the car seat, from the car seat to Walmart, past the toy section without getting the 15th Buzz Lightyear doll. Out of the, you know, I had one little boy, sweet kid, but man, he collected Buzz Lightyear dolls. And mom just said, we're not going to get another one. And she was pulling them out of Walmart, and he was screaming, call the police, call the police. And, you know, landing gear is up. He sees this being dragged across the concrete floor, and all the cameras are, you know, zooming in, and security comes over. And it's, like, really embarrassing for mom. But these kids have these very strange needs. They cover their ears. They cover their eyes. They push their fingers on their eyes. They pick their lips. They pick their nose. They make strange sounds. And this is not every child, mind you, okay? I mean, there's a spattering probably of each of you who's listening tonight. If you have a child with special needs, you'll say, yeah, mine has these fixings, but not those two. They tantrum severely. Sometimes you know exactly what the trigger is, and sometimes you don't have a clue. Fevers can come and go. They could be real emotional. One minute they could be having a great time, and the next minute they could be really sad. I remember my son had this real emotional ability. He'd be sitting in his favorite spot in the whole world, the shallow end of a pool with his G.I. Joes, and that's just like, that was his happy place. I mean, that's just, life is not better. And there would be times where even there, he'd be sitting right, sad daddy, I cry. And you don't know why. I mean, they don't even know why. It's just this emotional flip-flop. Some odd body movements, too. I see some very funky, weird body movements in these kids. When they're in my clinic, well, obviously I can see poor eye contact. If they're hyperactive, they're jumping all over the couch and the table and the chairs, you know. They're climbing. They have, obviously, language issues. They don't play properly with trains. Now, I'm not saying all. I mean, I have other kids who play really great with trains. Trains are their thing. It's their OCD, and one of the reasons why I have in my office. They come in with very restricted diets, very self-limited diets. Very rarely do I have a kid, oh, my son eats everything. He's just great. Or my daughter does. No, they come in very limited. In fact, my son would only eat at one time Chips Ahoy cookies, bacon, and Fruit Loops, and a gallon of milk every day. One french fries, that was it. Okay. But being a good pediatrician, back then I gave him a Flintstones vitamin. Well, that obviously doesn't do it. The physical exam, when I look at them, I could see dark circles below the eyes. They have dry, pale, translucent skin, dull hair, straw-like, white tongue, like we talked about, that thrush, dilated pupil, low muscle tone. They could have some masses in their tummy, usually poop, and enlarged lymph nodes. So what's biologically different? This is just a list of things that I consider in the Rolodex of my mind of things when I see kids. I think when I think of gut problems, for example, I'll think of inflammatory bowel disease, reflux, esophagitis, gastritis. You know, if anything ends in itis, it means inflammation, and inflammation hurts. And I had one little boy, sweet kid. He was a savant artist, and boy, he was self-injurious and just a real grumpy dude. And this was early on in my working with these kids, and I couldn't figure it out. And I asked him, draw me a picture of how you feel, because this kid was just miserable. And he drew me a picture of himself. It looked pretty cool, but he drew a campfire right over his left chest. And I thought, dude, you're having reflux. You have esophagitis, man. And I put him on, you know, like Pepsin or Tagamet or whatever back then. And within 2 or 3 days, he's the sweetest kid. No more self-injurious behavior. In other words, when these kids do something, they're not doing it because it's fun, or they're not doing it because they're autistic. They're doing it because something's not right, and it's up to us to try and figure out what it is. And it's not always easy. I mean, sometimes you have to do blood work and poop work. You know. Immunologic, they could have persistent viral illnesses, food allergies, recurring illnesses, autoimmune disease. Neurologically, they could have seizure, low muscle tone, perfusion problems in the brain. and opiate effects like of gluten and dairy foods. And on it goes with the metabolic issues there too. And they have these delicious things that we can work on. And you know, that's why when people say it's all viruses, well, some people, yeah, that's true, it's viral. But another person say it's all heavy metals, it's the mercury in the environment. And maybe they're true with some of the kids that they are mercury poison. And on it goes. So when I look at these kids, all these people out there who are telling you exactly what it is are right, but not for every kid. I mean, you can chelate my son until the cows come home. I mean, there's no heavy metal in my boy. Okay. So we just have to be careful. And then some people say, well, it's chromosomal. So what are you going to do with it? It's chromosomal. Well, first of all, there's no such thing as a chromosomal epidemic. And I don't think even the staunchest of deniers would say that we're not in an epidemic of autism. This is not a fad where parents are asking for their kids to be labeled autistic so we can get benefits. I mean, my wife would say, oh, well, then all we have to do is not ask for our kid to be autistic and I'll go away. So, no. But even if it was chromosomal, and I'm wrong, and 1 in 10,000 kids it really will be chromosomal, the other 9,999 will be right. But my eyes, because of genetics, I have 2200 vision. And they didn't say, well, because it's a chromosomal aberration, you just won't be able to see. They said, no, let's find the right prescription for your eyes so you can see and perceive the world like everybody else. So even if this is chromosomal on your child's part, it would be our job as physicians to find the right lenses, so to speak, so he or she can see and perceive the world kind of like everybody else, or at least closer than what we have now. So when we look at restoring their health, we want to kind of break the gridlock of these vicious cycles and try to restore normal function. Remember, back to that cell again. It comes back to that cell. So we're going to remove things that can be hurting them from a dietary point of view. And that's why you hear about gluten and dairy. Bolster nutrition. Obviously, if you have a child who's eating four things, like my son, where was my son getting his vitamin C? Where was my son getting his omega-3 fatty acids? So they can actually be depleted on that. And if I'm going to have any chance to repair the body, repair the cells, repair the tissues, then I've got to provide the building blocks. Just like when you're building a house, you have to drop off the sand and the bricks and everything, the lumber. We have to drop that off. We have to take care of the inflammation. We have to put water on the inflammation. We have to kind of improve the broken biochemistry, yeah, which are from a gene point of view, but like I showed you with B12, I can kick that methylation factory in the hiney and get it to make some more glutathione for us. Improve the immune function, especially if you've got one of these kids who's sick all the time, got sick, ear sick, or whatever, and detoxify. Very important. So what are these meaningful interventions that we can talk about? Okay, that's where we're going to go now. So here's a picture of a little girl just full of poo, and you can see that easily from the pubic bone to the belly button. There's this shelf, and some parents would say, oh, you mean the Prager belly look. I said, yeah, the Prager belly look. And then you can see after we disimpact her, it's a six-month process. It doesn't happen overnight. We can get it nice and flat. Now, can you imagine if your tummy is distended to the point where you look pregnant and it's caca? How are you going to react with your therapists? Can you imagine going anywhere to work or anything with a belly that's so distorted from poop? And now they're going to put you in a class of calculus, and you've got to learn calculus and take a test. I mean, it's just not going to work well. So just by the fact that I decompress her bowels, I've already made the therapist's job that much easier because she's in a happier, more receptive mood. We could take an x-ray of it, too. And the x-ray, as you look at this on the left-hand side, that's full of poo-poo. In other words, air is dark, and denseness, like poop or bone, as you can see, is white, and there's a lot of white in that belly, and it shouldn't be there. Compared to the one on the right, as you look at this, you see a lot of darkness in there. Okay. Now, I mean, if you were here, I could trace out the bowels for you and show you exactly where the poo is, but an x-ray can do it. And then, obviously, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, but if you look in a diaper and you see this sandy, foul-smelling mush compared to squiggles at the bottom of the toilet, you can tell there's a difference there. And by the way, guys, this was a Christmas card I got 1 year. So I do get some interesting pictures, as you can imagine, over the years. Now, when we look at the bowels inside, in other words, we do an endoscopy where we stick a little camera up the hiney and go through, we can see abnormal tissue, and it hurts. Okay. So as you look at this picture on the left side, that's looking in the large colon. It's in the colon. You're actually inside it there with a camera. I hope I'm not grossing anybody out. And those are swollen lymph nodes because they're inflamed from infection. Now, the one on the right shows what the colon should look like normally, smooth and pink, just a nice, you know, the colon just dehydrates the stool, pulls water out of it, and the poop just slides through the colon. So you can imagine, you know, when you've had a sore throat and the mom or the doctor would reach under the neck and say, oh, my glands are swollen, they're tender, and it hurts to swallow. Can you imagine? That's what this feels like in the colon. So as food and stuff passes through, it hurts. It hurts. And some of these kids don't even know what it's like not to have bowel pain. They've always remembered bowel pain. They don't know it's not supposed to hurt. This is the esophagus. Okay, this is the swallowing pipe between the mouth and the tummy. And the picture on the left, if you look on the 8 o'clock position, you'll see like this cobblestone street. That's inflammation. That's reflux esophagitis. It's supposed to be smooth as silk. And you can see that it's swollen and tender. And that hurts a lot. So a lot of these kids don't want to eat just because it hurts. Now, the arrows here show where there's disease. And this is in the small bowel. And this is by a pill cam, and this is my son, because he had small bowel disease as well as large bowel disease. He had, if you will, canker sores. If you heard a canker sore in your mouth, you know, they're kind of uncomfortable. He had canker sores all the way through his small bowels. And this is taken with a camera in a little pill that they swallow. I mean, obviously, my son learned to swallow pills early on because of his mom. My beautiful wife said, oh, you are so taking pills because I'm not going to be giving you all these liquids forever. So anyway, he learned to swallow like a champ, and he swallowed this camera, and it takes pictures through the tummy, 4 pictures per second as it tumbles through. And for the first time in a living human being, we can see what's going on in the small intestines. And he had a lot of disease there. Here's a picture. You can kind of see it. You got this white ring. It looks irritated. It looks like a canker sore or the gum, but this is really in the small intestines. So you can see why they can posture. They can roll themselves over the couches. They can put pressure on their tummy. You know, roll over a ball. They can scream, they can hit themselves, and they can run intermittent fevers. Okay. So again, we have within the medical community the capability of taking care of this. You just have to say, oh, he's just autistic, that's why he's so grumpy and irritable and hitting himself. No, actually he's got inflammatory bowel disease, and I can use a name here, but I won't, doctor. Let's treat it as if this was a neurotypical kid telling you, my tummy hurts. So, abnormal bowels. When the bowels aren't working properly, we know it. You know it. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not so obvious, but this is what it does. They have soiling in their pants. They just leak. They have constipation, or they have diarrhea, or they can actually have both. They can have loss of appetite. We call anorexia. They're just not hungry, or they graze throughout the day. They just kind of eat a little bit each time. They can wake in frequently at night. They can have reflux, foul-smelling stools, and foul-smelling breath. I mean, their breath can smell like caca or fish. When my son got this odd bacteria growing, he would have this breath that smells like fish, okay? And, of course, the protuberant belly. So laboratory evaluation, what would I get if you told me about these things? Well, I would get something called the urine organic acids test, and I would check for urine opiates and peptides to see if we really need to be off of gluten and dairy. I would look at the stool because their immune system's not working so well, so they may have some funky little buggies growing in there. And I just had last week humongous worms in one kid. I mean, just really impressive. So, you know, if I'm impressed with you guys might be thinking. Food sensitivity issues, they can have true inflammatory bowel disease. So obviously, we have to identify that. They can have overgrowth of yeast, overgrowth of bacteria, bad bacteria, parasites. They can have problems with digestion or food. I've had parents tell me they can see the bite marks in the french fries the child eats in the poop, or the poop smells like vomit. Poop should never smell like vomit. I might get an x-ray, and then, of course, if the kid's sick enough, I might force some poor unwilling gastroenterologist to do endoscopy for me. Well, what is poop anyway? Let's get down to basics. I mean, you know, What lecture isn't complete without a description of poop? 10 parts of water, 1 part of bacteria, 1 part fiber, and 1 part of mucus, fat, dead cells, and protein. That's what it is. And we can learn a lot from looking at stools. Now, we do know that autistic children have a problem with their gut. I mean, this has been published many years ago by Dr. Karoli Horvath. It's over, it was done in 1999. And it's like it says, the results, histological examination of 36 children revealed grade 1 or grade 2 reflux esophagitis. So that's 69% of the kids that you look at. Chronic gastritis in 15, chronic duodenitis. Remember, itis means inflammation. So chronic gastritis means inflammation of the stomach. And at the end of the stomach, there's a structure called the duodenum, so duodenitis. And then he talks a little bit more about what he saw. And he also said, by the way, they don't make digestive enzymes very well. So that's why we talk about putting kids on digestive enzymes. That's why we talk about, at least initially, putting kids on antacids. That's why we talk about getting them unconstipated so the food can go somewhere. Because a lot of issues are right in the tummy. In fact, I tell parents that when they come to see me the first time, the first place I start is the gut. And very rarely do I have a kid with a totally normal gut. Now, he's got autism, but his gut's fine. He eats great. He poops great. Poop looks great. That's not a gut thing. Very rarely. Mostly, the gut is just part of it. And if you come to me with 10 problems with your kid, whether it be sleep or speech or whatever, if I fix the gut, invariably 5 or 6 of those problems go away. So it's kind of a nice way. It makes me look really good. But more importantly, the child is out of stress and out of pain. Very large stools. Again, I throw in some studies so you can see that what I'm talking about is science-based. Now, when I lecture to doctors, it's the other way around. Most of it's all studies and very little of it is talk because they want to see that what I'm talking about has been validated. Constipated with children with mega rectum in children with autism. Conclusions, constipation is a frequent finding in children with GI symptoms and autism, particularly in the rectosigmoid colon. That's the last part of the colon. Often with acquired megacolon. That was published in 2003. And yet, if you talk to your doctor about this, the doctor will say, well, he's got autism. And everyone knows autistic kids willfully withhold their stool as it's an area of their body that they have control over. Really? What animal on God's green earth willfully withholds his stool? Now they have a problem getting rid of the poop, and it's our job as physicians to heal the pain, to get that going, okay? It's not that hard, as you can see. If you're constipated, it's not hard to fix. You just have to address it. It's not always the easiest thing to do, but you get to it. Large amount of gas. I have some kids who are, and by the way, the fancy name for gas is flatulence. Large amount of gas. They're passing gas all the time. It can be due to fermenting organisms, incomplete breakdown of sugars, polysaccharides. Air swelling. I have some kids who gulp air, and they get these big, air-filled tummies, and old stool sitting in the bowels, just decaying and putrefying, and these anaerobic bacteria, these fermenting organisms, just grow like crazy. You know, Grandma says, if you don't take out the garbage daily, the rats will grow. In this case, if you don't go poop completely every day, then things are going to grow. And don't be fooled. Some kids, they'll poop every day, but they only poop about 2/3 of what their body makes. So over time, they accumulate. The parent will say, my kid poops every day. He can't possibly be constipated. Oh, yes, he can. That's sometimes when an x-ray will be helpful. This is the nicest stool picture, very glamorous, that I could find, of soft-serve ice cream. Okay? This is not soft-serve ice cream. That is caca. Poor absorption and digestion. Fructose intolerance. That's way too much sugar in the fruit drinks that they're drinking. Or they're eating too much fruit each day, they eat 15 pieces of fruit. Could be from dairy, lactose. Ose means sugar, so fructose is fruit sugar, lactose is milk sugar. And, of course, sensitivity to gluten. Okay, but mushy stools are not normal. Snake stools, that's when they have these little tiny squiggles, bearing down against a partially closed sphincter, they're straining. There's a fancy word for straining with bowel movements. But, again, normal or abnormal? I'm really a simple guy when it comes to doing this. I just look at it and say, is this normal or abnormal? And if it's abnormal, then what do we know in 2012 that we can do to fix it? Pebble stools. They could be small, like rabbit pellets. They could be huge, like grapes stuck together. If you're from the Middle East, you'll describe it as goat pellets. And these kids don't drink very much, too, many of them, all right? So It could be a problem with fluid and just sitting in there too long. But bottom line is, I've had kids pass stools as big as grapefruits. Colors in stools. They come in all different colors. Yellow usually means there's fat in the stool. Red means there's blood or the child's been eating beets. Green is almost always a gut infection. Black could be blood or bismuth, like Pepto-Bismol, or iron, if you're giving iron. Whitish gray, lack of bile flow. That's coming from the liver, so we have a problem with the liver. And reddish black, that's kind of an emergency and a susception. Okay, looks like currant jelly, for those of you who know what currant jelly looks like. Gut disorders and autism. Well, sometimes I'll get a historical clue, which is kind of cool. Difficulty breastfeeding, persistent colic. Oh, I love colic. You know, when I was in medical school in the 80s, colic was usually described as a well-defined time each day, starting somewhere between 5 and 6 weeks, lasting for about 3 weeks, usually about 4 hours, and you could set your watch by it. And that's what colic was. So a mom tells me my kid is really a fuss bucket between 6 p.m. and 10:04 every night. That sounds colic, and he's 6 weeks old. But colic nowadays seems to have morphed into this all-day fussy baby thing forever. I mean, he's colicky at 2 weeks, he's colicky at 12 weeks, he's colicky at 3 months of age, just a fussy, cranky baby, and say, oh, that's colic. That's something new, because that wasn't around in the early 80s. Reflux, infantile eczema, food sensitivities, failure to thrive, that means they're not gaining weight, frequent antibiotics, that means they're destroying a lot of healthy bacteria in the gut, abnormal posturing, self-injurious behavior, poor sleep. Those are clues for me that there's a disorder of the tummy. Lab clues, abnormal poop, abnormal cytokine profile. These are from the lab. Now, I have to do this. Lymphonodular hyperplasia of the ileum, that's from endoscopy. That's when the GI doctor takes a look at it. And then inflammation of swallowing pipe called the esophagus, or the stomach, gastritis. But when the stools improve, sleep improves, eye contact improves, word approximations may start, tantrums remarkably get better, appetite improves, they're actually trying new foods. They just seem to be happier in the skin that he or she is in. And the health improves. It's amazing. Now, let's switch over gears. We were talking about constipation now. Now we're going to talk a little bit about diarrhea. Diarrhea can be 1 to 6 or even more liquid movements per day. They can be explosive. They're usually very foul. And they can have varied colors. But they really, the thing that's really distinctive about them is like, I've never smelled some of the smells that come out of these kids' hymens before. And I've been around all kinds of stuff, the autopsy, whatever. This is really foul stuff. And the pediatrician may say, well, you know, that's toddler's diarrhea, and they don't want to do anything about it. So what I tell the parents to do with one of these diapers is you come into the office with one of the diapers in a Ziploc bag, and while you're waiting to see the doctor, you open up the Ziploc bag and you open up the diaper and you let it aromatize the room. So therefore, when the doctor comes in, he's not going to blow you off and saying, that's normal. Because let me tell you, if you have one of these kind of kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And your point will not be made until the doctor is able to see and smell. You know, the reason pediatricians used to wear a bow tie was because they didn't want to wear a regular tie because they periodically and routinely examine the stools. Because the stools are part of the exhaust pipe, if you will, and not of a combustion engine of a car, but a metabolic engine of the stomach. And, you know, you can get behind a car and it's chugging out blue smoke or black smoke from the exhaust pipe. You don't have to be a mechanic and say, hey, there's something wrong with that car engine. It's not doing something right in there. Well, the same thing, when you look at the exhaust port of our children, you can look at the stool and smell it and say, hey, something's really wrong in that tummy system. So what do we do to manage diarrhea? Well, we have to try and figure out the source. Is it from the foods they're eating? Gluten and dairy are huge. 80% of my kids, 80%, benefit greatly from the removal of all gluten and all dairy-containing foods, not most or some. Or, you know, gee, doc, my kid's 80% dairy-free. Shouldn't we see something? No, it has to be 100%, kind of like a light switch. The addition of digestive enzymes, antibiotics to kill certain germs that have been growing there, or any fungus, they got yeast, or parasites. You can't kill parasites with garlic. You got to do the real deal there. Adding zinc, adding fiber, very important for the management of diarrhea. And then there are certain things that I can actually add, like monolaurin, or ionic silver, or transfer factors, such as colostrum, oral immunoglobulin. That's off-label, out of prescription. You won't be able to do that. Consider immune deficiency workup. In other words, why is this kid's gut so darn sick with these germs? and Secretin IV. I'm putting these down because I don't know where all of you are in your looking through the internet. I've got some real investigative parents that are really reading everything, so I kind of put a little bit of everything here. But if this stuff is really foreign to you, you've just been diagnosed with a child with autism, then don't worry about some of this more technical stuff. You don't need to learn all of it. This doc said, you know, we don't treat constipation in little kids. Okay, they just have to work it out themselves. Look at what the poop is doing to his posture, his back, and look what it's doing to his front of his tummy. Okay, so you guys are now all experts. You can look at that and say, dude, that guy is full of stool. Okay, FOS, full of stool. You may think of a different word for the S, but I would say full of stool because that's professional. And irrespective of where he is on the autism spectrum, I can make him so much more agreeable to hang with than leaving him like that. Okay. And what I mean by agreeable is that one mom put it a couple weeks ago, kind of cute. She said, I love my kid very much, just not so much at 3 a.m. Okay. Sometimes we love our kids a lot, but hanging with them is not the favorite thing to do. They're just being real pains. And what I want to make it is where they're really terrific to hang with all the time. They may have lots of them, but you just love being with them. Okay. So constipation, we could take an x-ray of it. We've talked about how they can be small balls, pellets, softball size, very foul smelling. They can also have a genetic disorder called Hirschsprung's disease. You need to take care of that. I mean, these kids are real kids. They can get real stuff too. So here are my treatments for constipation. Enemas daily for up to a week if necessary, because you got to get the plug out. Or you can use a glycerin suppository. Polyethylene glycol, that's another name for Miralax or Glycolax. Aloe, fiber. Vitamin C. Magnesium. These things really should be done with somebody who can help you through this, obviously. You don't want, as a parent necessarily, doing this the first time to a 2.5-year-old. Okay, I mean, nobody's going to hurt a child with glycerin suppository once a day for a week. But if you start adding Miralax and Aloe, you probably want to have somebody help you there. Fiber. Soluble fiber helps prevent constipation, which in turn diminishes the potential of dysbiosis. There's a lot of good fiber choices on the market. We use cage fiber at our office because it virtually is undetectable in our kids' drinks. And the last thing you want to do is give a kid something and they won't take it. So I try to find the things that are pretty much undetectable in their fluid. So even if, you know, if they're drinking a little bit of juice, it's easy to hide stuff. But if they're not drinking juice, they just drink water, then it's going to be a little bit harder, a little more challenging to get them to take stuff. Dysbiosis. Stool studies can give us information of what's growing in the bowels. Urine studies can also, believe it or not, give us information of what's growing in the bowels. Fungal cultures, parasite cultures, and looking for things in the microscope will tell us what's going on in there. And I got to tell you, when you kill the bacteria, when you kill the yeast, you have a different kid. It's amazing. It changes their behaviors. The kids who are climbing, jumping, spinning, or the kids that are mean, aggressive, pinching, biting, it's not coming from between the ears. In other words, it's not coming from the brain. It's coming from something going on in the bowels. When you fix the bowels, that makes those other behaviors kind of fade away, which is really awesome, because then you get to see what kind of child you got. Yeast is a big issue with our kids. Many of them get on antibiotics. Many of them don't have an immune system that can fight yeast. This is what yeast looks like under a microscope. And when I went to medical school, we had to do all of our own staining and culturing and everything. And we would call this the spaghetti and meatball sign. So we could see yeast really easily when we looked at it. You can grow it. And this is what it looks like on a stool report. And under mycology is the study of fungus, you can see Candida albicans on a scale of 1 to 4. It was a 4 plus. So this stool was full of yeast. Now, what kind of behaviors? These kids could be giddy. They could be up at night laughing, maniacal laughing. They could have a bloated belly, flatulence. The poop can actually have a bakery smell or a hop smell, kind of like a beer, hops beer smell. They're climbing. They love to hang upside down. The treatments that I use, I put in here, so you have an idea. Obviously, these are all prescriptions, so you're not going to be able to do any of these without a doctor, but in case the doctor's kind of nervous, you have the dosing right there. There's some natural things you can do. The problem with natural things is they taste terrible. That's why they're herbs. Herbs are very pungent in taste and smell, and many of our kids, it's not enough to give them regular food, let alone take your oregano, dear, or take your garlic. Okay, they're just not going to do it. But there are kids who will, and there are kids who will swallow pills, so I didn't want to ignore that. But there are some very good ways to keep yeast under control. Now, when I talk about yeast, it's really better if you've got yeast, especially heavy growth of yeast, to use fluconazole, which is the antifungal. And, you know, sometimes moms will kind of object or, you know, kind of go, and I said, well, when you've had a vaginal yeast infection, did you ask for herbs? Did you want garlic? No, you wanted the little diflucan pill now, and you wanted that to be gone tomorrow. So these things I tend to work with to keep yeast from coming back. Once I've cleaned it out with an antifungal, then I will bring this on. Now, there are naturopaths and homeopaths who obviously go this way only, but you don't know really how far you can go because you don't know how much you've really killed. Just food for thought. And again, I'm open. If I have a parent say, I don't want to use any of the drugs, I just want to use the natural thing, I'm all for it and I do the best I can. So I'm not trying to sell anybody any particular way. I'm just showing you the different ways that we can go. Now, if you have a bacterial infection of the gut, once again, I guess maybe because I'm an MD, right? Give them an antibiotic, okay? I don't come in there with garlic and oregano. Those can work, okay? But I'm just telling you my preference is I want the child to be as good as they can be right now. And if they continue to get recurrent, then I will explore every natural way possible. But once again, I'm open if I have a parent who doesn't want to do it quite that way. Okay? It's not my way or the highway with families. Dysbiosis, you definitely got parasites growing. And then I'll use metronidazole. Now, once you get parasites, that one's going to be a little tougher to kill naturally. They're pretty tenacious critters. Once they're growing in you, it's kind of hard to get them out. So we'll take care of them. And they can cause behavior. So I mean, once you treat them, they get a whole lot better. Small bowel erosions, kind of talked about that a little bit. There are ways to treat inflammatory bowel disease. They are mostly all drug-oriented initially, to get it under control. And then we have lots of natural anti-inflammatories like curcumin and Hanfu is a great product and stuff like that. But if you've got real disease, I mean, if you've got appendicitis, you can't treat it with herbs. You've got to have the real deal taken care of things. And I just still to this day where I've worked with lots of families, we work with lots of, you know, alternative medicine folks, when you've got IBD, it just doesn't work initially. Now, mind you, once you get it under control, these alternative methods can be very, very helpful, okay? So these are just some ideas for treating inflammatory bowel disease. Now, you may also have inflammation in bowels because you've got some viral things going on, or you've got, and you treat with antivirals. You can use pigworm, Trichura switchova. You actually give the child a mild pigworm infection. It doesn't stay in the body. It doesn't spread. But it causes a reaction where the immune system takes notice of the pigworm and leaves the inflammatory bowel alone. Kind of cool. IVIG, curcumin, omega-3s. Curcumin I love. I use curcumin on just about anything that can take it. And there's some good products out there. And Hansa is one of them. Long Vita is another one. Omega-3 fatty acids. I'll use high-dose omega-3s. So they are anti-inflammatory. Pain and discomfort management initially on, a little bit of ibuprofen. You know, I mean, that can cause tummy pain, too, so you'll be careful of that. L-glutamine, zinc, very important for inflammatory bowel disease. Esophagitis, that was the picture I showed you earlier. It's a common response to something allergic going in the tummy, reflux. Common response, something going allergic in the tummy. It's like a small vomit that the stomach is trying hard to get rid of it. It's finding it obnoxious. And we have to find out what that is. So we try to remove that, like the area or whatever. It's associated with lots of ear infections, sinus infections, and asthma. Dietary changes can help. And acids promote healing, because once it's rip-roaring red, you have to heal it up, because if it stays chronically inflamed, that can become eventually, and sometimes, cancer. And you have to obviously take care of what's going on downstream. If the stomach has no place to push the food because you're full of stool, then it's going to kind of just sit there and it's going to reflux up. So you have to use antacids initially for a while. I don't try to keep kids on for long, because if you're on antacids, you can't absorb calcium. So, reflux treatments, removal of these exogenous allergens, these medications here, your doctor will have to help you with. Sleep. Sleep is a great one. I love working with kids for sleep. I can, not too many kids in the years I've been working with them, I've not been able to get to sleep. I had one dad of great means once promised me a Porsche box drive up to pick the color if I can get his kid to sleep. He hadn't slept for 5 years. And I got him to sleep, but the guy was so tired he forgot to send me a Porsche Boxster, so I didn't remind him either. Melatonin, 1 to 3 milligrams at bedtime. We know that these kids don't make melatonin. That's what his study shown, so I give that a try. Now, melatonin does have a potential side effect where you give it to them and they go to bed great, but man, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning they wake up and it's like, they slept the whole night. They are not going back to bed. I can't use melatonin in those kids where it just shuts them down for 4 hours and then they're up. So that's a one strange side effect. I can use it forever. Like I said, if your child is not making thyroid, I give you thyroid. If your child's not making insulin, I give you insulin. If your child's not making melatonin, I give you melatonin. Okay, that's what I'm doing with these kids. It's a hormone. 5-hydroxytryptophan, give that before bedtime, 100 milligrams, 50 milligrams. That increases the amount of serotonin in the brain, which is very common. And serotonin also makes melatonin. And so I can get melatonin going. So sometimes I have kids on melatonin and 5-hydroxytryptophan. I give them the calcium magnesium with dinner, because calcium magnesium can be very common. Vitamin D at dinner. GABA, aminobenzoic acid. Cortisol replacement. Now that gets a little tricky, but sometimes these kids have been so stressed out that their adrenal glands aren't making cortisol. Vitamin B6, anthelic acid, inositol. I use a lot of inositol. So I'd say the three things that I use most common are melatonin, 5-HTP, and inositol. Because the kids who wake up in the middle of the night are usually not going into a very deep sleep. And inositol is a natural way to induce deep sleep. It's not medicine that's putting them to sleep, but it, once they are asleep, it really fosters them to go into a nice, deep sleep. Then if I have to use medications, I can use Benadryl at bedtime too. So I get Benadryl and melatonin and 5-HTP. You see where I'm stacking it? If I have to use drugs, I might use clonidine. Some people talk about trazodone. I don't like using that drug. Some people talk about risperidone. I don't like using that drug unless I also have a kid who's not sleeping, but he's also not eating. And he looks like he just walked out of a concentration camp. Okay, really skinny, really fragile, and therefore I'm going to break the chains that keep him obsessed with not eating certain foods. And also, risperidone is a great appetite stimulant. So if I have a kid who won't eat, who's obsessed with not eating and not sleeping, that's a great drug. I hate to use it, but sometimes I have to, maybe for 30 days, 45 days, to get the brain accustomed to critters sleep at nighttime, critters eat food. I mean, basically, when you come to me, before I work on anything, I want a kid who's pooping and peeing, sleeping and eating. I mean, doesn't that just make sense that no matter where we're at, if we're not pooping, if we're not eating, if we're not sleeping, everything else doesn't matter. Okay. Here's an article looking from Biological Psychiatry. We talked about this, a novel biochemical model linking dysfunction to brain melatonin in autism. So we know these kids don't make melatonin. So if you have a child who's not sleeping and they're not waking up because their bowel's killing them, then obviously they probably would benefit from some melatonin. That's an over-the-counter medicine, but would be hard about there. Dietary recommendations. Of course, we're going to remove dairy. Again, like I said, 80% of my kids benefit from this. No testing, no doctor, you just do it. You can get information from a lot of sources. Generation Rescue's got great sources how to do it. They've got moms who can mentor you. Taka, TACA, talkingnow.org. They also have a tremendous website on how to be gluten-free, dairy-free. They have moms that will mentor you. Very, very important. Selective removal of specific foods if your child may be sensitive to. I can tell you without doing any testing, whatever your child is addicted to probably needs to be removed from the diet. So if I said to you guys, and I can't see you, but I'll bet you're all out there nodding. If I said to you, if you had a child come into your office and mom said, my kid eats 8 lemons a day, which I had once, by the way, I had 2. You'd say, I don't need to do any testing. That's probably not right. Let's not give him any more lemons. I have a kid who eats 8 bananas a day. Probably there's something in the banana that's driving him kind of kooky. Maybe we better get away from bananas. That's without testing. So if you're sitting there and saying, my kid's a sugarholic or a carbo junkie, maybe we should cut out the sugar. Maybe we should decrease the carbs. So you're going to hear a lot about diets, and everybody's out there waving their arms saying, my diet's the best diet. Okay, there's the gluten-free diet, the dairy-free diet, the specific carbohydrate diet, the low-oxalate diet, the phenol diet. You know, I mean, there's no end to the diets, but the best diet is the one that works for your kid. In other words, if your child is not allergic to almonds, why would I take almonds out of your diet? Okay, but these people would come and just blanketly say, your child needs to be on this diet. Okay, there are ways that we can detect whether your child needs to be on a particular diet or certain foods removed. But again, you're going to need a doctor to help you with that. Be as organic as possible and cook from scratch. That way you don't have to read the boxes and see if things are hidden in there. If the child's eating meat, fruits, and vegetables, and some type of gluten-free carbohydrate bread, you're in good shape. You don't have to read anything. Medically prescribed diets are a tax deduction check with your accountant. But really, anything that your child needs above what a regular kid needs and a doctor writes for them as a prescription, then you can add that as a contribution to tax deduction. Now, here's a beautiful 8-year-old boy, bright red cheeks, shredding his room, pulling his mattress apart, angry, mean, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. His pediatric psychiatrist at the Children's Hospital of Oakland said, this boy has severe mood and thought disorder. He needs to be put on lithium at age 8. I said, lithium? Are you kidding? This is my second boy, by the way, John. John taught me, before autism was even on my radar, that foods can make your behaviors absolutely crazy. And he had systemic effects from sugar. You can see the flushing of the cheeks even in this old picture. And just angry and mean. And I did the strong-willed child and the dare to discipline. You can go on horseback riding if you're good. You lose your baseball game. He's wearing his baseball jersey. Of course, he didn't play that night. If you're bad, he's always remorseful. And he had problems with focus and concentration. And I was the breakfast guy when the boys were growing up. I always did breakfast for them. And I noticed one day that after he drowned his waffles with pancake syrup, I guess in that case waffle syrup, he went off like the 4th of July. And I said, I wonder if this is sugar. So I removed sugar from his diet, and we haven't had a problem since. Okay? In fact, if he wants to stay up all night, he'll drink a can of Coke because it just gets him wired. He's in college. He can stay up and study. He's a senior. But this kid was really, really scary. This was even before my fourth boy, Joshua, with autism, was even born. So already back then, I was being prepared to understand that diet can really affect behavior. But how can it do that? I mean, really, why didn't somebody know that? Well, here's the study. Eicosanoids, as inflammatory mediators, the sugar link to mood and bad behaviors. So it's been proven, and that's why teachers will tell you that around Easter or around Halloween, kids' behaviors can get kind of rambunctious. So what do we need to do with our kids as far as nutritional supplements goes? Well, like I said, they're very limited in what they're eating, so we need to be able to get some vitamins and minerals in them. They need replenishment because of this self-limited diet. Now, they need less replenishment if they're eating an all-organic diet and say, hey, doc, my kid eats everything, fruits, vegetables, meats, he's great. Then less supplements I have to give them. Digestive enzymes, we already described from Crowley-Horvath's research on autistic children that many of them don't produce enough digestive enzymes to break down the food that they are eating and absorb it and ends up going into the poop. And if you put food in the poop, then obviously if you have, sounds gross, but if you have a lot of delicious food in your poop, you're going to have lots of organisms munching on it. It's going to be a veritable smorgasbord. So you're going to have the propensity to grow things that you normally wouldn't grow. It's just all that food was absorbed by the body. Omega-3 is crucial to start that, if anything. Omega-3, I had a little grandmother come up to me when I was in my residency program in Biloxi, Mississippi, and with Kisa Air Force Base. And this is back, you know, when I was young and in residency and thought I knew everything. She said to me, if you ever had the child who's so to speak, give him some coffee bowl oil, doc. And I said, yeah, right, you know. But I remember that. And when my son was so to speak, I started him on coffee bowl. Back then, it was really the coffee bowl oil that you grandmother had. And it was really awful smelling, awful tasting, rancid. And within 3 days, I got words from my kid. So an eye contact and less scoping and less looking out the side of his eyes, flickering his fingers. So omega-3s are really, really important. So if anything, tonight, I want you to start the kids on omega-3, go gluten-free and dairy-free. I don't even know your kids, but probably all of you guys are already doing that anyway. Soluble fiber, very important for bowel health. We already talked about that. And vitamins, very important. Like I say, if we're going to rebuild these cells, if we're going to resuscitate them from their oxidized, battle-worn, torn cells, they need to have their vitamins. So it's very important to provide sufficient amount of vitamins and minerals as well. And you can read that on your own. We don't have to go through that. I kind of want to get to your question and answer, so I bet there's going to be some really cool things. We can actually measure the vitamins and the minerals in the bloodstream. You need a doctor's test. But generally, these kids are very low on zinc, very low on selenium. Almost all of them, unless they've been obviously on supplements. So we definitely will start the children on it. Digestive enzymes we already talked about, but very important, breaking down food in smaller components. The enzyme class proteases break down the proteins, and you have lipases, which bring down the fats, and on it goes. We use a state-of-the-art enzyme called KH enzymes. Omega-3s, we already talked about. We can measure omega-3s in the blood. We can do what's called an omega-3 fatty acid test. It's a blood test. You can do it in LabCorp, Quest. Everybody does it. But the doctor has to ask for it. On the other hand, I can take a dietary history and say, well, we're not getting omega-3s in our diet, which usually comes from fish. And we can't eat fish because most of it is either farmed, which is bad, or it comes from the ocean. There's mercury. So those are the... we're kind of in a rock and a hard time. You all shouldn't be eating much fish. In fact, you know, you buy a can of tuna, and I'll warn you, if you're pregnant, don't eat this. Okay. So if we don't want to give it to a pregnant mom, I don't want to give it to a kid who's got struggling brain recovery issues. But our overall goal, why are we doing the supplementation anyway? Well, we're trying to optimize normal physiology. There's that word again. Optimize functioning immune system, enhance cognitive abilities, improve red cell membrane function, reduce autistic behaviors. We all like that. Improve gut function. Well, we can see how important, I mean, most of the time tonight has been spent on the gut. And minimize the negative genetic influence. In other words, the things that the child has been born with. And that's like, and you got to think, B12 injections, those B12 shots you might be reading about. That's a vitamin, but we've been giving it through a little needle. So it's kind of a big thing. So finally, getting down to the last part here, the endocrine, abnormal feedback controls of the thyroid, adrenal, pituitary glands, and other glandular functions. Well, when the thyroid's off, you know, that's like one of the master glands of the body. And there could be lethargy, or just kind of couch spuds, abnormal weight gain, constipation, mental slowness, dry skin, thin hair, poor growth parameters. We can do lab work. We can get the check the thyroid gland completely. And we can ensure that the child's getting plenty of iodine because we're not taking in iodine because we're not using Morton salt, for example, the little gal with the umbrella iodized salt. We've gotten away from that. We're the sea salt, so the organic salt, and we're not giving any iodine, which is so darn important for the thyroid gland to be working. So make sure that we have some source of that. And if the thyroid gland isn't working well by testing, then I'll put the kids on thyroid medicine. Just like if the melatonin isn't being produced, I'm going to put them on melatonin. I can certainly measure thyroid using the melatonin. And then I remove sources of fluoride and chlorine because they affect iodine uptake in the thyroid gland. And then there's the environmental load. And this is all the other stuff that's in the house. You know, the off-gassing of the carpets or the off-gassing of the new paint or the off-gassing of the new cabinets that have formaldehyde in the press board wood, or mold from a leaky roof or something like that that's in the wall, house dust mite, perfumes, cleaning agents. We've really got to clean up the place. My son was extremely sensitive to mold and house dust mite. In fact, while I was trying to figure it out, in his bedroom, I just ripped up his carpet and threw it away. And we had a concrete slab. That's kind of how they build things. And he's has been on a concrete slab, you know. And then we put down those snap and click floors that you can get from Home Depot when they're on sale. Obsessive compulsive behavior. Well, what do we know about that? Well, Dr. Sue Sweeto at NIH actually thought that and demonstrated that a certain amount of these kids have this streptococcus growing in them. At least what we think is streptococcus. And if you eradicate the strep, the OCDs or the ticks or both get much better. So we have to think about PANDAS. That's pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with streptococcus. So you can get a child with ticks and OCD behaviors. Then we have to think about that. But it's a clinical diagnosis. You certainly can do some blood work. But really, if I have a patient who's once we vitaminize, mineralize, oralize, fixed his bowels, got all that going, but you're saying to me, gee, doc, he's still very OCD, still very perseverative, he's still got a lot of anxiety, I might just go ahead and clinically treat him with Augmentin or Zithromax or Keflex or Omnicef, asking the question, is there a germ called Streptococcus, word-like organism, that is responsible for your kid's OCD behaviors? In other words, if you've got a bacteria that is causing your OCD behaviors, why would I put you on Prozac? Now, that's what the medical community would do. Let's go for the course. Let's go for the throat here and get rid of the germ, and then maybe your OCDs will get better. This is very common in my practice, by the way. I have a lot of PANDAS kids, and when they go on the antibiotics periodically, man, it takes their 8 or 9 out of 10 on the Richter scale OCD behavior and bring it down to 3. You got to keep in mind, though, that the family history usually has a lot of OCD, mom or dad. You know, my clinic record is a non-blow vacuum in your house 8 times a day. So genetically, I know this kid's predisposed to OCD, okay? I'm sure she has a very clean house. And now she may have some issues that I might be able to take on later, too. But I'm just saying that if OCDs and anxiety run your family, then these children... The children tend to take the traits of our parents and like an amplifier, turn it way up to distorted. Okay. Inflammation, well, we talked about that. You know, there's a lot of things that cause inflammation. That's all the itis is. And we've got to put a handle on it, but sometimes you can't always find where the itis is. Okay. I mean, obviously, if you got reflux esophagitis, we put you on an acid. And if you've got colitis, inflammation of the colon, then we have to fix that up. Sometimes it's viral. We have to look at blood work to see if we got some viral causes of your inflammation. But it can be large bowel disease, small bowel disease, all the things we're talking about. So I'm hoping now that this is making sense to you and that you're understanding that there are medical interventions that we can undertake to make the children better. And I think, what happened there? Oh. It just froze on me there. Okay, so. All right, there we go. Inflammation, allergies. Allergies can be big. And I always put these kids who are allergic on Claritin or Zyrtec and Singulair. And if they got a lot of nasal symptoms, I'll put them on Nasonex. They have a lot of gut allergies to different foods. I'll put them on Gastrochrome. Love quercetin. It's herbal. And some kids are allergic to it. Quercetin is a natural allergy medicine. And then sometimes I have to send them to your local favorite allergist to help us with shots or something. Of course, addressing the inflammation in the gut is very, very important. They're not going to get better if they have chronic inflammation. Sometimes we have to use an anti-inflammatory now and then. Motrin and Advil, if I'm really stuck and I'm trying to figure out if a kid's got inflammation, I'll say to the parents, let's put them on Motrin 3 times a day for 5 days and see if he gets better. Focus, concentration, therapists are saying, oh, wow, we had the best week with your child. Then I know that we're still got something that we got to deal with. I can't keep them on Motrin. Some doctors recommend Celebrex. I try not to use that. Naprosyn's Aleve. I try not to use that. Actos. I don't use that very often. Steroids. Sometimes if I'm really stuck, the kid will come in with croup. I just had one, and they have croup, so I can justify putting the child on steroids for croup. And parents very often will tell me the kid's language improved dramatically. And this, again, these are clinical cues that I have done everything I need to for that child's inflammation. Long Vita, Neuroprotect, natural agents, curcumin, omega oils, picogenols, those are all very good. Language, you know, that's another big thing here. The supplements that I use to see if I can push language, carnosine, carnitine, Namenda, which is a prescription, GABA, gabapentin, steroids. I don't use steroids very often. I hate using steroids, but sometimes I use them as a diagnostic probe to see if I'm on the right track or not. Anti-seizure medications. A lot of children, 30% of my practice, have seizures. If they're having seizures during the day, they're not going to be able to talk. So it's very important to get an EEG somewhere along the way if we're really stuck here. Cognitive function, focus, concentration, carnosine, CoQ10, 600 milligrams there is for big kids. Remember when I'm talking to a group like this, I'm talking from, you know, one-year-olds to teens and young adults. So when you see some of these larger doses, it's not safe for your four-year-old, okay? Ginkgo biloba, American ginseng, DMAE, L-theanine, carnitine. These are things that can help with focus, concentration, and cognitive function. And guys, I think that's about it. I'll leave you with this as you guys tabulate the questions for me. This is a four-year-old recovering child who may have had some misspellings here or there. I think you might appreciate that. And I'm ready for questions as soon as you want to ask them, Nancy.
Okay. I was reading the letter.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now, I told you, I forget sometimes and I become mom. So I want to let our callers know that if you would like to ask a question, press star 2, and that will raise your hand and alert me that you have a question, and then I will patch you through. In the meantime, we'll go to the questions that have come in through the website. We had a question here. Who assigns supplements, the nutritionist, the GI doctor, the pediatrician?
Whoever feels most comfortable with working with your child, okay? So the pediatrician, his whole idea of a nutritional supplement might be a Flintstones. Well, that's not going to cut the mustard, okay? So some docs out there who are working with our kids, these special needs kids, have a good feel for what is needed. Other docs, they really don't want to be bothered. So the best choice there would be a nutritionist, of the three that you gave me, who specializes in working with autistic kids. But the caution here is they love nutrition. That's why they're nutritionists. And they will put your kid on 60 different things because he needs them all. He needs, and they make a great case. He needs these 5 things for the brain. He needs these 4 things for the gut. He needs this for muscle tissue and growth. He needs this for his eyes. And you've got a $500 bill before you know it. Okay. Plus, you've got to try and get all of this stuff into your child every day, especially the picky ones. So the nutritionist who really knows how to work with our kids and our parents won't just give you a huge list of everything you need and you walk out with a $600 or $700 a month habit. The next thing that I always tell parents is I am a clinical doctor. I'm looking for clinical results. I need that if I'm going to put a child on something, you better see something of it. Now, obviously, if I put your child on calcium, you're not going to see bones grow. And if I put your child on omega-3 fatty acids, you may not necessarily see, brain cells work better. But if I put your kid on B12 shots, or if I put your kid on these things for language, you better see language. And I don't mean 9 months from now. I mean in 6 weeks. I'm kind of impatient. So if we're going to work, and that's why I broke them down, cognition, language, sleep. If I'm going to put your kid on sleep stuff, you better tell me my kid's sleeping great. The next thing when it comes to nutrition is you don't start everything at once. You pick the one thing you want to take care of first. The nutritionist, once again, is going to come up with a whole bunch of stuff you need, unless, again, they're very wise and they know moms and say, let's just try these 5 things and see how they work. We first start with sleep, and then we work with the bowels, and they kind of go together. So the nutritionist probably, because your GI doctor doesn't have time for you and your pediatrician seeing 60 patients, and you don't quite fit in a 10-minute time slot.
we have a question here. It says, Doctor, how can I decrease the carbs if that's all he eats? If the 10-item food list is only carbs, what will he eat?
That's a great question. I love that question because that was my son. He wouldn't touch protein for 2 years. And it was great because the first protein he'd eat was filet mignon. So there we are, the whole big family's eating dinner. We're all eating hamburger except for the autistic kid. He's getting filet mignon. And David, my oldest son, says, Dad, why does he get the filet mignon? We get hamburger. It was really cute. I really struggled with that. First of all, a reason why they don't eat protein very often is because they don't have enough zinc. Zinc, Z-I-N-C. And when you don't have enough zinc, protein really tastes foul to the tongue, okay? And you guys are welcome to fact check me. Just type in zinc and taste buds or something like that. The next thing is if you don't have enough zinc in the body, then the protein can't be processed properly, and it's turned into ammonia. And when your ammonia level goes up, you feel real poopy. So then you feel every time I eat protein, I feel poopy. I don't like the taste, and I feel poopy. And then they become my carbohydrate junkies. Okay. So that's one reason. So what do you do? In those kids who are drinking rice milk or whatever, you actually have to get some rice protein powder. And depending on their age, sneak in a couple of teaspoons or a tablespoon of rice protein powder. And again, this is all on mendingautism.com. And you can read about that, and you can actually get some in. Back in the old days with my son, I can't recommend this now because of salmonella and E. coli, but I would beat in an organic egg into his drink because I wanted to get protein and fat into him because it's all he would eat. Now, another reason why kids eat carbohydrates is because carbohydrates are altered into sugar when they're digested. So these kids are basically sugarholics. And what loves to break down sugar? Yeast. And when yeast ferments sugar, there's some byproducts, carbon dioxide gas, and alcohol. And these kids can be little microbreweries. They're little alcoholics. They crave sugar, or they crave carbs. French fries are turning sugar. I mean, my son is a diabetic. I can tell you everything that breaks down his sugar and how quick, glycemic index and all that. But these kids will crave bread, and they'll crave French fries, and they'll crave Pop-Tarts and stuff like that. And this is a child specifically who really would need supplements because of the fact that all he eats are carbs. And carbs provide calories for life, but they're certainly not going to add anything else to the repair process. So I would recommend zinc and evaluating the child for yeast and seeing if we can't sneak protein in a drink like a rice milk or an almond milk because I'm going to assume that he's already gluten-free, dairy-free. And you will find, I mean, these kids crave gluten so much that when you remove gluten, they're like little drug addicts. I mean, you really need to work with like a mommy mentor, like from Generation Rescue or Taka, to help you through that because they crave it. They'll eat dog food because it's got gluten in it. They'll if there's a cracker in the couch, they'll find it. You know, the whole house has to be gluten free. Good question.
Yeah, we had the hamburger bun incident in our house when we put my son on the gluten free, casein free diet. And my husband had gotten a hamburger bun out of the cabinet, and there was a tussle over the hamburger bun. It ended up in pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody got hamburger bun.
they will go crazy. But thank God we live in a time where there is plenty of gluten-free hamburger buns and bagels and carbs that you can get into. Back in the old days when we were doing this with my son, my wife had to make it all. And, I mean, we had no idea how to make gluten-free stuff. I mean, some of the stuff was just terrible. Some of it came out like hockey pucks. It was terrible. But nowadays, you know, it's a lot easier. The problem is it's expensive. If you don't make it, you got to buy it. And if you got to buy it, it's going to be a whole lot more. So, but the carbohydrate junkie, they're probably seeking gluten, and they're probably doing it because the gluten is converted to morphine in the body, and the morphine is what the brain is after. If it's carbs in general, then they're seeking it for sugar, and the sugar is feeding the yeast, which are fermenting alcohol. So you got little drug addicts.
Rita from Hawaii asks, what is synthesized tetrahydrocannabinol?
Cannabals.
Is this the same THC in medical marijuana?
Sort of not. Aloha. Dronabinol or the synthesized tetrahydrocannabinol is Marinol, M-A-R-I-N-O-L. And marinol is one of the many cannabinoids. It's tetrahydrocannabinoid, but it's one of the many cannabinoids found in marijuana. And it seems to be associated with appetite increasing. So, like, for example, patients undergoing chemo are anorexic. They're just not hungry. They don't want to eat. So they give them marinol, and the marinol stimulates appetite so that they can eat. So for my kids who won't eat because they're just anorexic for one reason or another, it's not because they're FOS, full of stool, then one of the drugs that I can use to help induce their appetite is marinol. And that's the cannibal thing you're talking about.
Is it a liquid, a powder, a...
It is a prescription capsule that you have to, especially if you have a child who's not swallowing pills, snip it with some sewing scissors and squish it into something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Want to remind our telephone callers that if you have a question, you can press star 2 to raise your hand and I will connect you. Diana from Shelton asks, we are having to replace the cortisol in our low-tone, low-growth hormone son. What might that be, and is there a natural replacement we could give instead of the cortisone we've been prescribed?
Hi, yeah, there is, and there I use the natural one that I use is Adrenoplex in my clinic when I don't want to use cortisone. But if you truly have an adrenal crisis, an adrenal problem that's not making cortisol, that could become life-threatening real quick. I mean, you can die from that. And so I don't know what the diagnosis here, so you've got to be very careful. So kids who have adrenal stress and they're not making enough cortisol, but they have the biochemical pathways to make it, they're not going to die. But there are some kids out there, again, these kids, even though they have autism, they can have real diseases too, you know, like appendicitis or whatever. But there are some kids who absolutely for the rest of their life need hydrocortisone, which is, by the way, bioidentical to cortisol. I mean, it's exactly what your body would make. Like my son, who is a insulin-dependent diabetic, I have to give him insulin every day or he will die, no doubt about it. There are kids out there, and I don't know this child's, and obviously I can't play doctor over the phone. There are kids out there who absolutely need cortisol or they will die, just like my son needs insulin or they die. You don't mess with that, okay? On the other hand, you have kids who have been stressed, and their adrenal gland is tired, needs a lot of vitamin C, and if it needs a little bit of bolstering, a little support, and you don't want to use hydrocortisone, Adrenoplex is a very good product to look into.
Adrenoplex?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? Okay. Okay, Tara from Arizona asks, have you ever had someone who had an opposite reaction to melatonin? I'm a high-functioning autistic adult, and it makes me hyper and irritable. She is gluten, casein, soy, and artificial-free, but still constantly constipated.
Hi, Tara. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a good point you brought up. And what I tell people is that almost anything that I do, I can get an equal but opposite negative reaction. I've had kids go completely unglued with vitamin C or cod liver oil. And I'm like, that's why I can't possibly have an ego. As soon as I think I know what I'm doing, there's going to be someone out there who's going to shoot me down and say, you don't know me at all. You give me melatonin, I'm going to be up all night. Yes, you're absolutely right. So constipation, that's a tough one. And like I said, you're doing a good job by going gluten-free, dairy-free, but every human being has the right to go poop. I mean, come on, that's basic right. And if you're not, then something's being missed. And sometimes some adults and all, they benefit from different supplements out there. For adults who are chronically constipated, I would recommend Colon Magic, ColonMagic, Colon Magic. I haven't seen that, okay, maybe once not work, okay? All herbal, naturals all get out, okay? But if this has been going on for your whole life, then it's going to take a while for your colon to shrink down to a normal size because it's probably stretched out, okay? Melatonin I give for sleep, and obviously if what I'm doing is, that's why I say I'm a clinical doc, if what I'm doing isn't working, then you stop doing it. And it's in the perfect example where melatonin puts you awake. So that doesn't mean that we're done with you. That just means that you have to go down that list of other things that we've talked about and see if anything can help you along that way. I don't use, unless for emergency, drugs for sleep. Okay, all those things that you see on TV for a good night's rest and all, I don't use those because usually that's fraught with disaster. Now, what I mean by disaster is they work for a while and they stop. If I have to use something, you know, like that, I would use an herbal. One of them is called Seditol, S-E-D-I-T-O-L. And that's a good one for adults for sleep. But these are things that you probably need to work with a nurse practitioner or somebody with who has knowledge of medications, herbals. It's just about, sleep can just about be managed 95% of the time with herbals. That's one of the areas that herbals totally, totally take over anything that's produced out there. Good question. Next.
Okay, Linda from Mount Laurel asks, how long do you keep a child on fluconazole? My son has been on for over 2 years, and I worry about his liver.
Hi, Linda. That's a great concern. Liver. So, first of all, we have to make sure the liver's happy with us, okay? And you have to check it periodically. So every 2-3 months, somebody may be doing liver function tests. The next question I always want to know is, well, why do we need it? Now, when we're on fluconazole, for those out there who are not quite used to all these words, that means the doctor is suspecting that there's yeast. And fluconazole is a very complicated drug, and it may not be killing yeast. It may be doing something different. In other words, parents will tell me, Doc, I know you want to get my kid off of fluconazole, but really the next day, if he misses a dose, he's just a different kid. Well, yeast doesn't grow that quick. I mean, yeast is a plant, okay? It doesn't grow that quick. I could say you're off fluconazole, and a week later you're getting kind of snarky. You're losing language. You're slurring speech. You're getting kind of giddy. You're kind of getting this or that. Not the next day. So sometimes fluconazole is doing something really kind of odd. It doesn't mean that it's not working well and helping. I'm just saying it may not be killing yeast. If it truly is killing yeast, then I would ask the question, have we done everything we can to create the most hostile environment for yeast to grow in the world? Like garlic, like oregano, like monolaurin, and the list goes on. I mean, everybody's got their favorite yeast killers. Obviously, they've got to be products that you can get into your child because they're herbals. They taste terrible. Some of them do. But there are things that we need to, is your child having bowel movements every day? In other words, taking the garbage out daily. I had one kid, though. I had him on an azole, a different one. This is fluconazole. I had him on ketoconazole. As long as I had him on ketoconazole, he didn't have seizures. But as soon as I took him off, he'd have seizures. Nobody tell me what a cop could possibly be doing. So these complicated drugs might actually be helping our children in a different way than what we think. Just like when I say, oh, I'm going to put your child on this antibiotic to kill strep because I think he's got pandas and they get better. Well, maybe I'm killing strep, but maybe I'm killing two other organisms that I don't even know about in 2012. So we just want to first say, okay, we're pretty convinced this is yeast. Every time we culture it's yeast. Then what I would do is create an environment in the gut with probiotics and all these natural things to see if I can get them off. The next thing I would do is say, okay, if it's truly yeasty, then I should be able to get by with Monday, Wednesday, and Friday fluconazole. I've just cut down. And then maybe Tuesday, Saturday fluconazole and see how much fluconazole he really needs. But if there's a kid who, no, he can't miss a dose or he has a lousy day, probably doing something different. Kind of complicated. Good question, though. But that's complicated, but the most important thing, you're absolutely right, is you've got to protect the liver, and you might want to add things like milk thistle if you haven't already, just to help augment the liver. But somebody's got to be in there testing it every 3 months.
Linda also asks, after you heal
the gut, Linda.
After you heal the gut and your child is pain-free and has normal stools, would you consider a trial off the GFCF diet, or should that be continued?
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole goal, is doing all this stuff, is to get them so they can eat pizza with their buds one day. I mean, yeah, I mean, my son eats everything. I mean, my son was gluten-free and dairy-free and soy-free and corn-free and chicken-free and beef-free and sugar-free and potato-free. I mean, we were feeding my kid venison and aardvark and you know, rattlesnake or something. I mean, it was really hard to feed him. I mean, he was so sensitive to all these foods. When you fix the gut, then you kind of reset back to what God intended in the first place. In other words, if you're born allergic to peanuts, I'm not going to fix it. You're always going to be allergic to peanuts until, who knows, maybe somebody comes up with something, gene splicing. But for 2012, you're always going to be. Who's allergic to lettuce, for goodness sake? Who's allergic to rice in this world? You know, billions of people exist on rice, but our kids are. So you're absolutely right. So what I would do then is after we fix the gut and they're doing great and growing, I would do a IgG food allergy profile and see if we're still making antibodies to gluten, to dairy, whatever. And then I start to reintroduce a little bit of gluten. And it's really exciting. We do it a little bit at a time. Now, you could have three reactions when you introduce gluten. A, no reaction, that's what we're looking for. B, an immediate reaction, like that was stupid. Why didn't I even think I could start gluten on my kid? He's flipping out, he's getting crazy, he's craving it. And then C, the slow, insidious downhill thing. It takes about 8 weeks before you're out of the clearing. So when you introduce gluten, you don't introduce macaroni and cheese, and you don't introduce pizza. You introduce some crackers, you introduce some bread, you introduce regular toast. So if it doesn't go well, you can remove it. You don't start in with all the forbidden fruits that these kids are dying to have, especially when they're older. I mean, we introduce gluten in a 12-year-old with pizza and bagels and stuff like that and find out 2 months later that wasn't a smart thing to do. Good luck getting rid of that in this diet. So go slow. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. Our whole plan is to fix the gut so they can eat all the good stuff that's out there. And you didn't work this hard so they can eat a McDonald's thing. Yep.
Maggie from Winfield asks, what would you say about a 4-year-old who goes from constipation to diarrhea?
Oh, that's very common. That's very common. Usually they go from constipation to diarrhea, they're really constipated, and I'll tell you why. If the colon is full of poo, and it's hard, and it's rocks, if you will, the diarrhea is basically stool that's percolating through and squirting out the fish. Okay, so the best way to figure that out for sure is to get an x-ray of the tummy called a KUB. Even when your child is having diarrhea, you get a KUB, and you'll be amazed. The radiologist will say, this kid has got a lot of stool and descending colon. And you'll be scratching his head and saying, well, wait a second, he's got a lot of stool and descending colon, but we're having diarrhea, how can that be? Because it's percolating through. So very often I have kids who have alternating diarrhea and constipation. They're pretty much constipated kids. You really want to prove to me that we're not, that we really have these big fluid shifts in the bowels going from one thing to the other. Usually isn't like that. That'd be very interesting. It'd be a fun one to work on. But I would bet you 2 paper clips that we're bound up in there, and you go ahead and prove it and get that x-ray.
Diana from Shelton asks, can we test for glutathione levels? Is that a test my regular pediatrician can order?
Well, it's a test that any doctor can order, whether they will or not. That's a totally different question. You can order glutathione levels, and you can get that from several laboratories. Great Plains Laboratory has one. Genova Diagnostic Labs, G-E-N-O-V-A. That's called an oxidative stress panel. You can order the kit. And Genova is a good resource. You can go to, I can't remember what the website is, but if you just Google Genova Diagnostic Lab, and then you can look at the oxidative stress kit, and that will give you a nice figure on that. And then the doctor orders it, and you go and get the blood drawn. They fill the tubes, send it off, and you send in your Visa MasterCard. Now, some of these tests aren't going to be covered by insurance. Okay? It's not like checking a CBC or thyroid. It's going to be, you have to pay for it.
Yes, I know that all too well.
Mm-hmm.
Allie from Sarasota, Florida asks, if a child is currently on digestive enzymes, will they always need to be, even in adulthood?
Hey, Allie, no, I don't think so. Again, my son was on a lot of digestive enzymes. A lot of kids need a lot of support early on, and as their gut rebuilds and repairs itself. I mean, having a child who doesn't make digestive enzymes in a general pediatric practice, the only one I could think of is cystic fibrosis. Making it, they just can't get it out. And that's what brought us to this whole idea about digestive enzymes, in that this is way back when my son was having diarrhea, me being a pediatrician, looking at it and smelling it and saying, this is like what I see with children with cystic fibrosis, and I put him on Creon. And Creon's still available, by the way. And the diarrhea improved dramatically, Creon. So when the bowels are working properly, when the pancreas and everything is working with the right feedback loops, then they're going to make the digestive enzymes they're born to make. And, you know, when you think about it, the first 10 years of my general pediatric practice, except for cystic fibrosis, how many kids I put on digestive enzymes? I tell you, none. Okay, so, yeah, we want to, as they get better, the whole idea is to pull away all the support. You know, I still like them to be on as organic diet as possible and eating as good foods as possible, but they need less and less support. I'm sure there's going to be somebody out there who needs a digestive enzyme forever. I know that as we get older, like 40s and 50s, we don't make as many digestive enzymes, and us older parents certainly do benefit from digestive enzymes. But that's a different topic for a different time.
Okay, JP from Woodland Hills asks, how do I get my high-functioning young adult son, age 22, to change his eating habits, fast food, as he does not move his bowels regularly and he has stomach upsets often?
That's a very good question. The 22-year-olds, the young adults, are becoming very near and dear to my heart because my son being 16, it's like, holy cow, what are we going to do with this generation of kids? That's a tough one at this point. It depends on, again, high-functioning, reasoning. I don't know if we can reason with him. I mean, that's a tough one. Sometimes if the doctor says or the doctor shows lab tests to them, you can't eat these 5 things or 10 things, because they're kind of black and white kind of guys, they'll accept that. Oh, the doctor said I can't eat that, so I don't. Okay, and then they say, Dad, I can't eat that, remember? It's kind of cool. If they're addicted to the fast foods, then you just basically don't go there anymore. But then they may have a tantrum. And that's a tough question. That's a very hard question without knowing more about the child. But I can tell you that there are boys and girls or young adults, young men and women, who if you explain to them and show them on the paper they can't be eating that, they can internalize that and that can become their diet. If, on the other hand, they're obstinate, that's just the way they are, then the best thing that we can do for him at this point is work on the constipation. Fine, he's going to eat his fast food, fine, but at least he doesn't have to have constipation. If he can swallow pills, again, a product like Colon Magic or whatever can help move the bowels, irrespective of that, and you give him the nutrition that he's probably not getting from fast foods, if there is any. I don't think nutrition and fast foods even belong in the same sentence.
Oh, come on, now they serve fruit.
They do now, don't they?
They do.
That's right.
Okay, Lydia from Port of Spain asks, and you may have already touched on this, but I'll let you elaborate. If my autistic daughter is nonverbal and barely communicates, how do I know if she's having intestinal problems?
The body physique, that she has a protuberant belly. The quality of poops, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you say, look, I mean, there's nothing that I can tell that her breath is good. Her tummy looks like a little girl tummy. It's nice and flat. She makes beautiful stools every day. She doesn't tantrum before, doesn't tantrum after. She doesn't wake up at night. Then maybe that's not her problem at all. And it's time to move on to something else. Thank God she's one of the few kids who doesn't have abdominal issues. But if she's having diarrhea, constipation, rabbit pellets, and the poop, or passing large things, if she tears when she has a bowel movement, has hemorrhoids, I mean, if you see undigested food in there, I mean, those are all the clues that we were talking about. If she doesn't have any of those, then she's probably one of the few who the bowel got a pass, a get-out-of-jail card, and at least it's one thing you don't have to be worried about.
Okay, we do have a caller with a live question. I will unmute them, and you'll be able to talk.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Did you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. This is Maggie from Los Angeles. And
hi, Maggie.
I have a 24-year-old daughter who actually has most of the symptoms mentioned here. You know, she's got sleeping issues, a lot of gas, the big tummy. Takes a lot of seizure medication, sleeping medication, thyroid medication. So I'm trying to find solutions.
Okay, and your question is?
My question is, what could be done with this complex situation here?
Wow, I don't know how to answer that one. you need to work with the doctor. I mean that there's, like you said, you've got lots of issues going on. I don't have a simple pat answer. I mean, I'm not, because I have one of these children. I'm not going to sit here and just say, oh well, honey, she'll outgrow it, or just stay with your doctor. I mean, these issues that you're talking about, each one of them has to be addressed and fixed. Each one of them. Thyroid. Okay. She's on thyroid medicine. Great. What are her levels? We got her levels normal. Fine. On this thyroid medicine, with the way she is right now, thyroid's fine. Check. Next. Constipation. She's still having constipation. What is she taking for the constipation? It's not working. What adjustments can we make? We got the constipation better. Her tummy's flat. Check. Tummy's flat. She's on these four things for constipation. Sleep. What have we tried in the past for sleep? You see what I'm saying? Is like I compartmentalize and I put all the pieces of the puzzle together, and slowly but surely we get a kid who's pooping and peeing and sleeping and eating, whose thyroid is balanced, who goes to bed at 8 o'clock, who sleeps till 6:30 in the morning, who's healthy, not getting infections. Then I say, okay, here's a new girl. What's that problem? You'll say, doctor, all this work, and I still haven't heard her say, I love you, mommy. How are we going to do that? Then we start working on the language part of it. Okay, so each one of those has to be compartmentalized, and the inclination, especially at the younger doctors, is they want to work on it all at once, and they all are important, but you have to prioritize life-saving, life-threatening stuff first. Thyroid gland, very, very important. Constipation, very, very important. Sleep, very important. All of those have to be kind of worked on, and because you asked the question, it doesn't sound like you're too satisfied with any of those situations just yet.
Yeah, the thing is that, you know, for the sleeping, she's already maxed on certain medications. And then neurologist says, well, she's already on max and still having sleeping problems. And with the passing gas, you know, doctor says, well, you know, that's how people sometimes are. So sometimes, I'm not getting the help that I'm actually looking for.
I agree with you, and you have to change your doctors. And it depends on your insurance. If you're a Kaiser or something like that, you're screwed. You don't have any choice but to stay in there or pay outside the system because it's not working. If there's problems with the bowels and they're not getting resolved, I'm here in Irvine, California, so I'm just a little south of you. But, for example, there is one GI doctor, Dr. Collins, in Encino, California, who just loves on our kids. And if you've got bowel issues that can't be fixed, she's the GI doctor who can do it, okay? But I've got to tell you something, that you are being exposed to the same thing people all around this country, all around this world are, where they'll say, well, honey, some people are just, and fill in the blank, gassy. I don't know any kid who's just gassy,
yeah.
Okay? Growing up.
Is it possible to get that information for the doctors?
Dr. Brinny Collins is a GI doctor, Collins, Brinny, Brynie, and you can just type Brinny Collins Encino, and that information will pop up on the screen. But, you know, I'm talking to people all around the country, possibly around the world here, so I mean, obviously they can't flock into Encino, California, though they might like to with the way the weather is these days.
Mm-hmm.
But each one of these things, sleep, I because I don't know the medications, and I can't obviously practice medicine over telephone with the patient. I don't know. I can't give you specifics. But there's no excuse for not getting a child not to sleep. But if she's having abdominal pain, then of course she's not going to sleep. So that's why I always like to start in the gut before I branch out too far. I like starting with life-threatening stuff like the adrenal gland and the thyroid gland and seizures, epilepsy, obviously, and then move into those areas. I don't know if she's had an EEG. She may not be able to sleep because she's having seizures during the night. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, you presented a very, very difficult case. I mean, this is what I do all the time, every day. But that's a very tough case, and I feel your heart's breaking for her, but you're getting broken too.
Yeah.
I mean, sleep deprivation is still the number one torture in the world, you know. So I get what you're saying.
Thank you so much, Doctor. I really appreciate the help.
You're welcome.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Okay. If anyone else that's calling on their phone wants to ask a question, just press star 2 and you will be alerting me that you have a question. And let's see if there's some more questions have come in. Well, here's one from Beth in Ohio. She asks, what role does pyrrole disorder play in autism?
Good question, Beth. As you can see, there are multiple different metabolic things that can drive our kids, you know, crazy. They're just not being addressed, not being taken care of. Urine pyrroles is something, a test that you can do to see if she's got pyrrolurea. And then, obviously, there are interventions to help with that. When I looked at my slides that I presented under what's metabolically wrong with these kids, pyrroles is one of them, sulfation issues is another one of them. And for this kind of a presentation, that would be that could be a topic all to itself, really. But it's something that can be addressed and can be remediated, can be made better, so it doesn't have an impact on the child. That's a good thing, but it's an easy lab test to discern whether you have it or not. And I would probably say 7% of the kids out there have the elevated urine pyrroles that need to be addressed. And that means 93 out of 100 kids don't. But that's just one more thing that we get to work with.
This is a very common question. How do we know when our children are healed and they can be back on gluten? And you kind of touched on this before. You do a trial?
Well, actually, what I did, there are two ways, and I can go over them. Two ways. I tested my son. I did an IgG blood test. Mm-hmm. IgG blood test, and checked to see first if he had antibodies. So, it took my son, it's a lot different for the younger kids now, but it took my son over a decade of very, very strict dietary management. And I did, because I can, and I have the right wife. I mean, it was so. Our house was gluten-free, dairy-free. There was nothing that he can get into in our house that he couldn't get into. And there were times where I would just take the boys out, or my wife would take the boys out from their gluten-fixed Olive Garden or whatever, pizza. But in our house, it was gluten-free, dairy-free. The only time there was an infraction is it happened at our favorite place in the world, school. Okay, it's like, what? You gave him 8 Fruit Loops? Are you kidding me? And, of course, the kid's on his toes, eating and all that. So we did that, and then what we did was we started adding a little bit of gluten to his pancake mix or his waffle mix, or when my wife would make stew, she'd take his stew out and then she'd add a little flour for the rest of us or whatever. When we started thinking that this was something we could start actually adding back into the household. So we slowly added gluten back in, not in perceivable ways like here's pizza dude, but and then after about 2 or 3 months of different types of gluten coming into his diet, whether it be through bread or a bun, we realized that gluten wasn't going to be a problem. But, to this day, if we go like to Applebee's, he orders a hamburger and fries, he doesn't want the bun. You can go to In-N-Out Burger, guys, that's a great hamburger place out here in California, and he doesn't want the bun, okay, because he's so used to not eating buns with certain foods that just he doesn't care about that. But garlic toast with spaghetti, now that totally rocks. Oh, that'd be another thing. We would make spaghetti instead of using corn or rice pasta. My wife would get the real thing. Okay, so when you add things slowly back, then you have to keep in mind that certain foods are gluten-enriched. In other words, pizza dough is gluten-enriched flour. It's got like triple gluten in it. Bagels have like triple gluten. Anything that's rubbery and elastic is going to happen. So you stay away from those for a while. See how the tummy digests it. Let him work up his enzymes to digest it. See what goes on with the bowels. And most importantly, make sure it doesn't change sleep or behaviors.
Okay. Molly from Las Vegas asks, we have tried to stick to the GFCF diet with my autistic daughter, who's 8, but she's allergic to soy and other things, too. We avoid sugar and use stevia, but it's very hard to find foods that she can have. Do you have any websites or suggestions?
The websites or suggestions would be depending on what you're trying to do. First of all, I would love to hear that when she is on this diet, you do have a different girl. And when she, like you said, it's hard to stick to it, so that also implies that there are times where she doesn't stick to it and she gets something that she shouldn't, that she fall apart. I'm all about clinical here, okay? Mm-hmm. Meaning that when we're doing diet A, she is totally on. I mean, teachers are doing the Snoopy happy dance. She's just spectacular girl. She's doing great. And when she gets an infraction, like my son, there's a definite ding. That tells you that these foods are acting as a neurotoxin for her body. They're acting actually as a neurotoxin for her brain. And as I was trying to recover my son's brain, I was not going to let anyone, anywhere, put poison in his brain. No neurotoxins for my kid. And I became rabid about that. It just wasn't going to happen. So if you tell me, the other alternate question I get is, Doc, we've been doing this diet, this gluten-free, dairy-free diet, we're soy-free, we're corn-free, we're on all these things, and really, nobody can tell a difference. Then I got to question whether we're doing the right approach. So first of all, to answer your question, when she is strict diet mode, is she better? And if she is, then A, she's not ready for any introduction. B, anything that you or a teacher might think is a treat is really a neurotoxin for her brain. And over your dead body and smoking gun, are you going to let anyone poison your kid's brain? Or enough is enough. We are, and maybe I get a little too serious about this, guys, but you know, between my son and what I do, we're fighting for their lives. This kid is 8 years old. My kid's 16. We're fighting for their lives because if we don't fix them, I mean, as a parent, we don't really want to think about the future without us being on this planet. So I am not going to let anyone destroy my child's opportunity for the most he can get out of his life. So that's kind of, I'm kind of tough on that. But on the same side, I'm kind of softening that if it ain't doing nothing, then why are we going through all this? Let's find the things that do something and focus on those. So, I think a mommy mentor, either from Generation Rescue, and these are folks that you can talk with, or at TACA, and saying, hey, I'm here in Las Vegas, we have a Whole Foods, but our budget can't really quite stretch that far, or here are our issues, these are the foods that she likes, here's what we're trying to give. I think working with a mom who has been trained to work with you would probably be the best and easiest way to go. But I'd caution you that easiest way means easiest way in that this is the diet she needs. How the heck can we make this work with this constraint of finances or this constraint of foods that she'll eat? Okay?
That's very true. We went through the very same thing with my child.
And mine. Been there. And my kid was really into everything. Yeah. So, but on the other hand, I was going to give my son every chance of recovering him. See, you guys, my son was hurt with the MMR vaccine, okay? I mean, it was indefinite, as my wife put it, not me, a walking kill shot, okay? Now, what she meant by that was that it didn't kill him, but from a functional point of view, it took his language, it took his bowel function, it took his IQ, it took a whole lot, okay? And she was going to make sure that whatever we could recover, pushing me into the field too, whatever it took to get her baby back, she was willing to go the mile for it. And that's what we've done. But that's us. And not everybody thinks that way.
Mother warriors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it used to be when I would go to conferences and things, it was mostly women. Mostly moms. And now it's about 50-50. I'm very proud of the guys for stepping up.
The guys can, and I think the team has to be defined. In other words, some guys don't do well with the medical aspects. They're squeamish or they just don't. But they're really good at doing what they do, whether they be accountants or engineers or working at the job. They're really good, and the best thing that they can do is say to their wives, I will support you 100%. I will help you every way I can, but I don't understand medicine, and I really don't want to. Mm-hmm. So I'm giving you full carte blanche, and kind of like that old movie, The Princess Bride, the words they use is, as you wish. And that's a great team. Then the next team is where the husband is involved. Most of the time, he is helping making the money to afford the therapies and the food and all that stuff, and he's working side by side. And then I've got, on the other hand, the vigilante moms who ignore their husband completely. They're on the computer till 3 in the morning. They're hell-bent on finding the cure. They're ready to try everything. And they're snapping and irritable at everybody, including Dad, when he comes home. No words of praise, no words of affirmation, no meals at all. You don't understand this stuff. And they get really bitter and angry. Okay. And then on the other hand, I got the guys who are doing that, and women are actually working at, you know, in the corporate empire, if you will, and the dads are responsible for everything. So I get to see it all. The main thing is to find the right thing. You can't make a man do what he just doesn't have a skill set to do, and vice versa with the women. So somehow we have to find a media and talk about it and make it happen.
Well, I was 3 out of those 4. I wasn't the angry man, but I was every one of the other ones.
it doesn't make for a great marriage. You know, I did it one time because I was kind of naive. I told my wife, look, I'll take care of the medicine side. You take care of the school and academic side. And it sounded great, you know. I mean, because she's a woman. She's got her degree in child development. And I launched her into the wolves of the academic society where they got to do the IEPs. Now, my wife's a tough chick. I mean, weightlifter and marksman on the shooting range. And she came home after the first IEP in tears, and these women just ganged up on me and it made me feel like, I'm like, are you kidding me? They did what? And so I was like, no. And I said, no, just do it again. They won't do that. Of course, they shredded her, you know, the IEPs. You guys have been through that. And then I said, all right, I'll come. And all of a sudden, you have all these cackling women, and now you got a bull in the house. I'm just not, they don't know who I am. I've got my laptop. I'm taking names. And they couldn't have been nicer. And I said, you see, honey, how sweet you are. It's because you were here. I didn't do anything. So sometimes those guys are good for something, especially IEP meetings.
It's good to know you're good for something.
Yes. What's next out there?
Well, I told you the time was going to fly, and it is 11 o'clock in my world.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And so I want to thank you, and I want to ask you where people can go to get more information if they haven't gotten their questions answered today.
There's a lot of great resources, guys, out there. Like I said, I'm quite proud of my mendingautism.com website. It's commercial free. It's not there to sell anything. It's not there all it is a information from my heart, from my clinic, from my experience with the kids that I treat, real time, here's what I do. And that's all it is. And there's several topics, and I'm writing them as fast as I can. You know, it takes a lot of research where I put out, here's my thoughts on epilepsy, here's my thoughts on gluten-free, dairy-free, here are my thoughts on probiotics, and on it goes, and you're free to kind of browse that. The TACA website has got a lot of really good information, TACA now, talk about curing autism now.org. They have a lot of information. Kind of hard to get through, almost too much, but they have a lot of cool stuff. Generation Rescue has a lot of really great stuff. Parents, if you're young at doing this, you just got the diagnosis within 6 to 8 months, or you're out of denial. You've had the diagnosis for 2 years, but now you're out of denial and you're ready to work. Get a mentor. These gals live to help others, and they'll take you through it. They have lots of good advice. They're a lot freer to give advice. You see, as a doctor, I'm kind of constrained because I'm not allowed to say certain things. I can't be misconstrued as practicing medicine or giving you advice or creating a doctor-patient relationship. We're talking to another mom. She'll tell you everything. It's like, oh, yeah, you need to do this, and this. Okay. So work with the moms. And then, obviously, I think, you know, some of the stuff you can do on your own. You know, I wrote a real good book with Jenny McCarthy. And you may want to pick up a copy of that. And you can get it. It's cheap now for this paperback. It's called Healing and Preventing Autism. And it kind of goes through what we went through here. And I wrote it as if we speak. You know, it's just like sitting down. You can read it in one evening. Now, some people can't. Obviously, you've got kids screaming, you can't. But you can read it. It's really easy. You can pick out those areas that apply to your child, like constipation and diarrhea or not sleep, and see what we do. And there's just a lot of really good resources out there. And then finding a doctor. Sometimes you have to see a doctor who's far away because there are not too many of us out there who do that. You know, we were still taking in patients and nobody's really closed. But there are some good doctors out there who can help you through all this. But getting a doctor, then you can get the prescriptions. And for once, finally, you don't have to tell them what to do, which is probably the most liberating thing. They can kind of tell you what you need to start thinking about doing. But you know, like I said, I've got four boys. Joshua's my fourth boy. And I know that the autism really took a big hit out of his life, but I was not going to let it take a hit out of my relationship with the other boys or my relationship with my wife. And I was going to do everything I can to keep the family. It's funny, Nancy and I were talking about this before we all came on. You have to walk this road, and you have to walk this valley with your child. You have to, it's not negotiable, you have to do it. And you can do it angry and bitter and angry at God and shaking your fist, or you can do it with a sense of laughter and humility and a sense of fun. And, you know, so the kid wipe poop on the wall again, I clean up again. You can do it with a smile, and you can do some silly rituals to get the kids to sleep or whatever it takes. You can do it with a smile. You can do it with humor. I do. You can do it with a laughter in your heart, or you can do it angry and bitter. Point is, you're going to do it. Having done it both ways, guys, I'd recommend the happy and the humorful part. It's a lot more pleasant than being angry and bitter, because you're still going to do it anyway, so might as well be happy about it. And there are words that I can't use that my wife would to describe some parts of the journey. They're not professional for me to use, but you can imagine what they are, and they're very hard. But you get through it. And if you decide to really just, if you have a partner to do this with, a husband, a wife, someone special, then it makes it a little bit easier, because if you've got two or three links in the chain, it's a lot harder to break. So try and make sure you have somebody close that you can take this journey with. And as we were talking earlier, it is a marathon. It is not a quick sprint, I wish. Now, you'll hear people who talk about, oh, I put my kid on a gluten-free dairy-free diet, we treat him with antifungal, and he's cured now, he's mainstream. A little quirky like his dad, but he's mainstream. Those are what I call my lotto winners of autism. They got the real simple ones. Most of us, it's a very long road, it's a big struggle, and you fight for every game. But it's worth it, because it's our kids. If it was your husband, probably not so much worth it, but it's our kids, they're worth it. And that's what I'll leave you with.
That's a wonderful thought to leave us with. I also want to remind, well, first I want to thank you, Dr. Cartsonell, for being here tonight and for sharing all this wonderful information. I wish we had a lot more time, because I know there's a lot more to share. The GI is a complicated organ.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you, and hopefully we can have you back sometime and we can talk more on this subject.
Just say when. I'd be glad to. And we can pinpoint it, too, for what our listeners may want. You know, we could spend just one evening on sleep or immune system or whatever. You have my number.
Absolutely.
All right, so I'm gonna hang up. We'll have a good evening, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night. I want to tell everyone else that on February 8th, we will have Dr. Robert Nazif. He will be on talking about siblings. And if you want a transcript of this event, please join our Spectrum Gold Club. It's just $1, and you will receive a copy of this webinar audio and transcript. Plus, you'll have access to all of our previous webinars. That's over 40 topics, including Autism 101, the basics, sensory integration therapy, effective IEP strategies, and much more. Also, tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. Again, that number is 877-211-0212. Thank you all, and have a very nice night.